Okay, so did Al keep this agreement? Did you see it later?
We lost it. I don't know where it went. I looked out, I was just as happy. And also, I was given the casiba, the little document, casiba, which tells each party's obligations. And I don't even know where the hell that went, which is just as fine. I'm just as happy. I mean, talk about how our religions keep us subservient.
And so what, like, do you remember what the document contained, like, any details about?
I don't remember.
Just that you were
out property. Yeah, right. Literally, you know, on that signing over, the casiba itself, I remember, said all the obligations that a husband has to a wife, which is to support her, to provide children for her, for the family, and to take care of them or pay for them. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's that kind of obligation, the male obligation. And that the wife is to give, I think the only thing that the wife was obligated to do was to give him her troth. I think that was the only thing in there. But otherwise, there's a lot of details on what the guy was supposed to do. It was just... Anyway. But as I say, we lost it that same night. I mean, I was bonkers. I was out of it. Anyway, we walked down the aisle, and we had asked the rabbi to please keep the ceremony short, which he didn't. And anyway, we got through the whole thing. And big party afterwards. And... party I enjoyed. I didn't see much of Al at the party, because what I had also done was I had told friends of mine that my mother didn't want to invite, but I was getting married and they should come, especially the boyfriend who I had dated for such a long time, who the musician, and I danced with him a lot. But he's a great dancer, and Al doesn't dance, and it was, that part of it was real nice. Okay, so anyway, that night, we go back to wherever we were staying, and I don't remember what it was. And I was sick. I was sick the whole night, just vomiting and just everything. And the next morning, we got up real early and packed our camping gear and took off to Yosemite. We spent 5 days in Yosemite. My mother thought I was crazy. Who goes to Yosemite on a honeymoon? Okay. So.
We had a good time.
We had a very good time. I enjoyed it. It was really nice.
Yeah. Were you and Al romantic? Like, not in a, like when you were dating and right before your wedding, was there any like...
Al is not a romantic person. Al is a very sober, realistic kind of person. Let's get on with life. Which I found, at least at that time in my life, it was just a very good way for us to be dealing with it, because I was under a lot of stress to get through with school, which my father was against. My mother wasn't very happy. I was dealing with a lot of pressures. And he was a perfect companion, perfect mate. He's never been romantic, at least not romantic in the way that, you know, where someone brings you flowers and this kind of stuff. No, not like that, although I'm sure he's a romantic man, but he withholds a lot of that stuff like a lot of men do. But it comes out every once in a while, or it has over the years come out, but not in such an obvious way that he makes himself vulnerable.
What about his sexual relationship before you got married and after?
Yeah. It's interesting that when I was dating before Al, I tended to just date guys from school. And I don't know whether it was a particular guy that I dated, whether it was the fact that we were all students. I don't know whether it was the time. I did not have birth control available to me. I didn't even know there was a Planned Parenthood, which there was. But I didn't even know there was, I didn't even know there was one.
Did you know about birth control itself?
I knew that it was necessary to use condoms. However, it was not a part of my life to even think about having sexual intercourse with penis and vagina. And I don't know whether I was just real fortunate in the guys that I dated, or whether, like I say, maybe it was the class of the men I dated, or it was the guys I dated. I don't know what it was, but there was a lot of sexual activity. There was a lot of what we call petting. There was a lot of orgasm. I learned to have an orgasm without the guy even touching my crotch, which, you know, I mean, a lot of beautiful stimulation of, let's say, the breast, fully closed. And I know it was orgasm. I know it was, of course it was. I mean, I know what orgasm was. No beer. And it wasn't, I mean, I never thought in terms of penis and vagina, and the guys never did either. There was a lot of mutual masturbation, especially on my part with the guy. And But otherwise, there was no actual intercourse. So I wasn't concerned about birth control. And it was always part of that same thing. I don't want to get pregnant, so a penis is not going to be in the vagina, but we'll, you know, let's do anything else. Those guys who were real pushy, I never dated. I wouldn't see anymore. When I dated Al, it was a different picture. Al was a very good lover. Very sensitive, if there was any romanticism going on, it was a bad time. I mean, he's just super, super, very sensitive to my needs. And at some point, we began to have sexual intercourse. But he always knew where I was, or thought he knew where I was on my cycle. And he always used a condom when during a major portion of the month where there was a possibility I could get pregnant, and that was most of the month. If we did not use a condom during the month, it was maybe 1 week out of it, or 5 days out of it.
How did you know this?
He talked about it. He was knowledgeable, we also talked about it. Yeah, he took a lot of responsibility. I never got pregnant. And we had a lot of sex. A lot of penis in the vagina.
And how was it? Was that a big change for you, or did it seem natural?
It seemed real natural. It just was just a progression.
Mm-hmm.
Just a progression.
And you were real serious with him, pretty.
Yeah. All right. And this was all done. Well, there was two places that we had privacy. One was in the car. I mean, Kleinholz is the artist's name. Kleinholz, backseat Dodge, 1938, the backseat Dodge. Well, he didn't have a 38 Dodge, but backseat of cars were very common. And then he also had access to his father's shop. His father had a men's clothing shop, small men's clothing shop on Los Angeles Boulevard, Los Angeles. And the shop was really nice. So we go in there, we have privacy. So there were no hassles, there were no problems with any of that. I learned about infection. I had never had a bladder infection before. And after I began to have sexual intercourse, penis in the vagina, I began to develop bladder infections. Bad bladder infections.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And how did you handle that?
I wound up in the hospital on one occasion for 3 days. So, and it wasn't until later, after we were married considerably later, that I was able to put all that together. And, doctors know, I mean, they've done a lot of research that sexually transmitted diseases come as a result of sexually active people. And bladder infections are extremely common in women when we're sexually active. The more sexually active we are, the more common it is. In my case, I had only one partner, but I could trace it to vigorous irritation of the tissues of the entrance to the bladder, where there would be very tiny lacerations that bacteria, which is normally there anyway, can get a foothold on and begin to proliferate and then go up the urethra into the bladder. And I learned that if I were to apply some kind of a topical ointment immediately on the entrance, I could stop the bladder. I could prevent the bladder. Yeah. I mean, either shower or whatever point, but put something on to prevent the bacteria from gaining a foothold in that irritated tissue. Then there'd be less of a chance for it to go up the urethra into the bladder, which is what I still do today.
And that
stop it. Yeah.
What about the early years of your marriage? What were your expectations of when you went to Baltimore and were married? What were your expectations of the marriage?
I know my expectations were to continue a relationship with this guy who was such a good companion. And just, you know, continue to do fun things with him and live together. And we knew we were going to have children because everybody had children. And I started teaching in the city. And his work, his schooling, demanded long hours, so it was not unusual for him to be at the school, starting early in the morning and sometimes into late at night and sometimes Saturday and Sunday. Well, for the first couple of years, it wasn't too serious because I was a brand new school teacher and I had to spend a lot of time just getting used to the whole thing of school teaching. I had a lot of papers to grade, a lot of lesson plans to make. No, you know. Later down the line, that pattern of his began to offer real serious problems. My first kid was born 2 years after we were married, and we were living in student housing, very low rent. Our income was very low. He was on a graduate stipend, mm-hmm. and he was getting some money from his folks, which was really nice. And then whatever I could make, you know, for my part-time teaching. Although, but when the kids began to come, when they were real little, I was home. So our first kid was born. I enjoyed this tremendously because I've always liked children. I had so many years of babysitting and childcare, and so I reveled in this little boy who I could.
When was he born?
He was born in 54. Mm-hmm. His name is Murray.
How old was the pregnancy like?
Scared to death. I had very limited information. I did not have access to any information. I was married to a man who was a biologist who thought he knew everything and didn't know anything. The doctor I had was from Johns Hopkins. Murray was born at Johns Hopkins, and I had a very, very difficult labor. I was in labor for like on and off for about 36 hours. Mm-hmm. They forgot me in the labor room. They totally forgot me. And the morning that they finally took Murray, they said they had to take him with high forceps. The doctor comes into the room and realizes that I was still there. And I was also on drugs, Demerol, which was at that time especially very common to drug mm-hmm. laboring women, which I'm sure didn't speed up the labor. I'm sure it's one of the reasons why it was like it was. Well, anyway, they took me into the operating room or the delivery room, rather. I was out. They knocked me out, and they took Murray with high forceps, and I was physically sore for a very long time afterwards. Murray was drugged, zonkers. I saw him like 12 to 14 hours later, and his head
is
from the Demerol, right? And whatever it was they knocked me out with, because I was out. Yeah, I mean, I was actually out. Demerol, I was facing.
Yeah.
And when I finally saw him, his head was so badly bruised and so badly misshapen, and I was really worried that there was problems. And you know, he seems to be okay. He seems to be just fine. Yeah.
And how was it? Did you quit teaching when in your pregnancy, for example, did you quit teaching?
I taught until as far as I possibly could. The Baltimore had only recently changed its ruling allowing married women to teach. So the year I started, it was okay for me to teach because I was a married woman. Prior to that, only single women could teach. But they needed teachers, so they had to change the sexes, discriminatory laws. And pregnant women had to quit teaching as soon as they began to show. And that was at about, I think it was like about 3 months is when they drew the line. I taught to almost my 7th month, and I did everything I possibly could to not make an issue of the fact that I was pregnant, because we needed the money.
How much you made?
I made $3,200 a year. Big money. School teaching never pays. But the lower down you are in school teaching, the less money you make, even though the harder the work is.
What level?
I taught fourth grade. And then and we continued to live in Baltimore for the first 6 years of our marriage. Our second boy, our second kid, was born in Baltimore, also at Johns Hopkins, and 3 years later. And when he was 6 months old, Al got a job. Al had already graduated, had already done his postgraduate fellowship work in electron microscopy, and he had gotten a job at Rice University in Houston. So we packed up and moved to Rice University in Houston to a house there. And Kenneth was, my second kid was 6 months old, and I was 3 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
My labor, my delivery with Kenneth was super, super beautiful. Mm-hmm. It went very, very well. I had a better handle on it. I knew what was happening. And it just, with Kenneth, I didn't go into the hospital until the very, very last minute, so they couldn't do anything to me. And he was born in like three and a half hours. He was just super nice. He was born, his head was full, his eyes were alert, they couldn't drug me. And here was two boys. And Al was not in the delivery room with any of my children. And when they wheeled me out of the delivery room and I had this gorgeous little baby in my arms, he was a beautiful little baby. And I was so proud of this beautiful little kid, the job I did. And Al takes one look at him in the hallway, and he says to me, well, because he was a boy, well, I guess we could always try again. This is what he said to me. And I just went through this whole thing. They didn't say, oh, how cute, oh, congratulations, oh, I'm so proud, none of that. I guess we can try again, because he wanted it. Oh, he wanted it. Oh, God. Oh, the things we remember. So I figured, well, this went so well, I'll just get pregnant again. Yeah, we need a girl. So I did. I got pregnant. And by then, of course, my body wasn't ready to get pregnant quite so quickly. I hadn't recovered from Kenneth's pregnancy.
Did you breastfeed Kenneth?
No. I didn't breastfeed any of my children. It wasn't something that was pressed in the hospital. I wanted to be independent enough. I didn't want to be tied down. I had this idea that, you know, bottled milk was just as good. You know, formula was just as good. It meant that Al could also do feeding. And I just didn't want to be tied down. It was not something that, you know, we had this. It wasn't pressed in the same way. And I guess it's because we were in a pronatalist time. And if you start breastfeeding, you don't ovulate quite as often. And they wanted women to have lots of kids. So they just didn't press breastfeeding. So I got pregnant with Teresa. But meanwhile, we were also in the process of moving. And I had two little boys now. We moved to this house in Houston. And I saw Al even less. And I started getting worn down. I'm already hyperallergenic. We're living in an environment where something is blooming every single month of the year. So my immune system, my resistance is going down. So it's, you know, lack of sleep. And I'm pregnant. And so when it came time for me to have Teresa, when I finally went into labor, I just was a mess. I was a wreck. It was not as healthy a pregnancy. Her position was backwards instead of forwards. So she was, I had back labor with her, which was extremely painful. And they had to use forceps with her to get her out, too. They gave me a spinal, which I didn't want. So I was flat on my back for 12 hours after that. And, but we had a little girl. And she seems to be just fine, in spite of the high forceps. And then we were in Houston for 2 years, and he got another job offer at the University of Maryland. At that time, professors could move more quickly in their career ladder if they job hopped from university to university, rather than staying at the same place. And he did move very quickly up. And so we moved on to the University of Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., with my three kids in a little white house near the school. And again, I saw very little of Al. And our relationship began to deteriorate because of it. His time was totally devoted to, you know, making it in the business world, in the school world as a biologist, and putting up with all the pressures and the politics, which he's never been, you know, very good at anyway. And me, I was home, becoming more and more the little mother, little housewife, little whatever all.
Tell me about those days. What did you do during the days when you were home with the kids?
Boring, horrible. Get up in the morning, get into the kitchen, make breakfast for the kids. Al usually didn't have breakfast. He usually got something out of school. And put up with a bunch of kids who threw food all over the place. And sometimes they ate, sometimes they didn't. I didn't like it. I didn't like what women have, mothers have to go through in raising a family. And cleaning up the kitchen afterwards, scrubbing the floor down again so you don't track it all over your shoes and all over the rest of the house, making more of a mess, and then straightening up the rest of the house and dressing the kids and watching them and taking them wherever it is that you need to be taking them, out in back east, depending on the weather, you either went outside or you played inside, and then getting ready for lunch and making the lunch meal and then washing the laundry and making the beds or straightening up or stripping the children's beds because they wet them, or ta-da, on and on and on. Drudgery, watching the groceries, making sure you get over to the grocery store to get the groceries, making sure you do it at a time when you can take all of the kids or you have somebody else to watch the kids, and we never could afford to hire anybody to watch the kids because they always went with me. And it was just drudgery. Come the end of the day, I accomplished a lot, but I really didn't accomplish a lot. It was just maintenance. And it was boring. Boring.
No friends.
The only people I knew when the kids were little were my immediate next-door neighbors if they were friendly. And because we only lived in various places for 2 years at a time, other than the first place we lived in Baltimore, I didn't make any friends. I just was in the house all the time with the kids. And when they got sick, it was 24 hours. And Al was hardly home. Or he would take an occasional Sunday, and then we would go to the park. Or we would go to the zoo. And I would be so happy to go to the zoo, because then I could sit on a bench, and he could push the kids around in the strollers. I had Kenneth and Teresa sitting in a single stroller, and Murray would walk alongside. And I could sit at the zoo watching people. And I just, it was the nicest time of that period where I could just be left alone and he could go walk with the kids. It was awful. It was especially bad because we didn't take time for each other. And I really need to put the burden on him. Because all he wanted to do was be at school and do his research. And I just, you know, there was never any time for he and me as far as continuing to work on the companionship end of it. We began to lose it. And after 10 years, he was ready for another change again. So it was 6 years in Baltimore, 2 years Houston, 2 years in the University of Maryland, just out of Washington, D.C. That was 10 years. He was ready for another move. He got an offer from American University in Beirut, Lebanon. He got an offer from DePaul University in Chicago, a couple of other places. And I said, well, let's go back to California. Let's go back to Southern California, where we know the weather is nice, we still have family out there, we've left all our friends out there, let's go back to California. There's lots of schools in California. And he said, all right, let's make applications, see what we can get. So I helped him write his cover letter, and I helped him get his resume together. And by then he had something like 55 publications, professional publications. And so they were ready to grab him up. And he got a couple of offers out here. And he took the one at Cal State Fullerton, primarily because it was closest to the area in Southern California that I wanted to live. And, you know, he never said one way or the other, but I guess if he chose it, he wanted to live there, too. And I'm pretty sure that was the case, because his folks were close, and he was, you know, he still had a pretty close relationship with his parents. So we moved back out here to California. And that was in 64. And by 65, he knew that he wanted to remain at Cal State Fullerton. And 2 years later, we had our fourth kid. And it was at that point when she was born where I realized that our lives had just taken these different directions. Although I had, when the three younger kids had gotten older, I had gone back to teaching on a substitute level because I couldn't go full time. I still was identified totally with the family and as the mother, as the wife. And he and I had just gone our own separate ways. The only thing we had in common was the kids. And I knew it wasn't, I just was not happy. And I didn't like the role that I was into. There was nothing I could do about it, no matter how hard I tried. I was still being introduced as Marie's mother, Kenna's mother, Teresa's mother, and eventually Andrea's mother. I knew the neighbors only because of my children who were outside playing with the neighbors' children. I tried to locate groups that I could join, but I had no time with the work. You know, the job of mother, housewife, wife is reactionary. It's responsive. You're never really planning things out so that you know what's coming. I mean, a little bit, yeah, when you go to the grocery shopping, maybe. But pretty much your whole life is dependent on what other people need you for. And it's almost like a minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour kind of thing. And sure, I could plan on, what, I don't know, joining a women's group. But there was no guarantee I was going to be able to go to any meetings, depending on what was needed.
Did you join any group?
Yeah. In Maryland, I joined a National Organization of Jewish Women, which is a liberal group of Jewish women who were not religiously affiliated, but who were philanthropic. They worked on things for the Jewish community or for the community at large or whatever the activities were. And it was mostly an opportunity for women to get together, go to lunch together, and work on projects of mutual interest. It was liberal, very liberal.
How did you find out about that?
I must have read in the newspaper. I called up on the telephone. Other than a little bit of social contact, I never made any real friends, and I really didn't like the work we were doing. I was in it for maybe about a year before we moved again. When we were out here in Southern California, I looked up the group, and I didn't like the bunch. They were women who were a good 20 to 25 years older than me. The things that they were doing were very, very conservative. They were primarily in support of Israel, and Israel, growth of Israel, which I was not interested in at all in supporting. And there was one other group I looked up. There was no other group that I joined until 1968, when Andrea was 1 year old. By then, it was real high water mark for me. Either I was going to be committed to a mental hospital, or I was going to kill myself. I mean, I was just a wreck. I couldn't walk into the kitchen anymore. I couldn't boil water. I would get so nauseated. I had a very, very difficult time functioning in the house. I ceased to function.
Was it a conscious thing? Did you know what it was? I mean, just going crazy.
I was going crazy. I just was extremely unhappy. And Al was not able to help me. He couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And so he withdrew. And all I knew was I just hated my whole life. Absolutely hated it. And I was terribly bored and didn't have any friends. Hated the rut that I was in. Hated my kids. Hated him. Hated everything. Okay. 68, 69, I read in the Cal State Fullerton newspaper that women were getting together, Women's Liberation were getting together to meet and talk about women's lot in life in our society. And I went, it was a noontime meeting, and I walked 2 blocks up, and I sat down and joined the group, and it was mostly students. And did I get an earful? People were mad. Women were mad, you know. But I realized, whoa, it's not just me. There's a bigger picture to this.
And before that, was there any conception of the women's movement, or did you read The Feminine Mystique?
I read The Feminine Mystique when I was in Maryland. A friend of Al's, a male co-worker, a co-student, gave the book to Al to give to me. And I read it, and it began to make me aware of how sexist a society was. And I began to identify with a little bit of it as a graduate wife or as a faculty wife, professor's wife, because she's middle class, upper class, the upper class woman. And that began to help me understand a little bit. And that made me angry, made me very, very angry. I wound up just being really mad at everything. And especially mad at Al. He was the cause of it all. Up until our move to California, I still continued to do what I needed to do, I remember that I really tried hard to make everything come together. With everything. This was in Maryland. By the time I moved out to California, I gave up.
You were the kid,
so everything. My relationship with Al, things were not going well with Al. And I felt it was my fault. And I really tried hard to try to figure out what was wrong. I kept trying and trying and trying to do things that would make him happier, that would make me happier. I would try making special meals. I would try, you name it. And, you know, trying to bring things together so that we would have a happy family. And nothing worked.
And after you had Andrea, how was sexual relations?
Up until